Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center. For more information, visit theinternationalculinarycenter.com.
All right, we're bringing it in a little Skippy style. You have tuned in to the Heritage Radio Network, and you're listening to The Farm Report. I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks, and we are coming to you live from the back of Roberta's Pizzeria in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn. Today, we are tucking into our second episode of our three-part fiber series, and we are on the line right now with Virginia Sholamidi of The Yellow Farm. Virginia, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. So we're going to tuck right in because we have a lot of ground to cover, and I thought we'd start with a little bit of background on The Yellow Farm. You guys haven't been doing fiber production for the whole term of the farm. I saw from your website you used to train hunters and jumpers. What does that mean?
Yes, I was in my younger years. I rode horses and was a trainer, show horses for people. And then my children got into farming a little bit more, and sheep are a wonderful way to start taking care of animals. And I have been knitting forever. And we moved to a farm out in Delanson, and I decided to sort of switch over from the horse world and the horse business to do some raising of fiber animals instead.
Nice. And so you guys are located up near Albany in New York State, correct?
Yes, just a little west of Albany, out in rural Schoharie County.
In Schoharie County. And what is the size of your farm?
We have 65 acres. A lot of it is wooded, but we have some lovely old barns and a lot of pasture for grazing animals.
Nice. And so what prompted the decision into sheep, you said, was the kind of looking to make a change. You had an interest in fiber. So you guys are raising a couple of heritage breeds. So how did you kind of stumble into that breed selection?
Well, as I say, I was a knitter from early on. My grandmother and my mother knit, and a friend of mine introduced me to spinning, which is taking the fiber from animals and actually spinning it into the fiber you're going to be using to make a textile or knit with or weave with. And so I became fascinated in the types of fiber and the feels of the fiber, and researched quite a little bit on different breeds of sheep, and started with some that were fairly common and lovely, but ended up falling in love with a particular type of sheep who has a very individual style of fleece and a very individual look of fleece, and they are the Wensleydales and the Teeswaters. Those are the breeds that I am breeding at the moment. And I just absolutely adore the way they look, and I adore the way they feel. And the fiber that they produce is extremely unusual and is very coveted by hand spinners and people who are doing textured yarns and art yarns and very sort of creative projects. It really lends itself to that very, very well.
Can you tell us a little bit, between the two breeds that you're working with, what do they look like physically? What color? Or, I mean, is it curly or thick wool? Or, I mean, what? I don't know the language.
They are a very large breeds, both of them. They're very closely related. They originated in England from a very, very similar breeds, and they are very large and very curly. And if folks out there have seen some pictures of my particular type of sheep, they have long locks that hang down the front of their face in an almost Rastafarian look. They almost look like they have dreadlocks. And the fiber that comes from them, if you allow it to grow for a fairly long period of time, the fiber actually curls around itself in a dreadlock sort of a fashion and gives you this long, lustry, shiny, curly fleece and fiber, and that's what really pulled me to this these particular breeds, because the fiber is quite different than maybe a more traditional sheep that people are used to seeing, which is sort of fluffier and poofier. Mine have very definite curl in their locks. A little more unusual.
Nice. And I know if people are interested in taking a peek, they should definitely visit your website, which is www.yellowfarm.us. It's kind of, I would say, the OK Cupid of sheep sites. So that's such an interesting thing on your site there. Basically, you have pictures of a number of animals from your farm, and it looks like you're essentially pre-selling that particular animal's fleece. Now, Is that kind of an industry standard for this kind of smaller scale, you know, specialty breeds, or is that something that you kind of have found success in?
It's something that I pretty much have had my own success in. Most of the time, people that breed sheep shear them and take that raw fiber to a fair or a festival or perhaps a yarn shop or a guild, where people then come together and look over all of the fibers that are available and purchase their fleeces from them directly. My breeds are so rare that I have found, if I put them on my website with a picture, that people are very happy to reserve them almost 2 years ahead of time for the next particular shearing, because they're very difficult to get, and also because we keep our sheep, we raise our sheep for the hand spinner, so that their fleeces, they're coated so that they don't get a lot of what spinners call vegetable matter, which is just hay and grass and stones and stuff, organic stuff that would normally work its way into the fleece. If you coat them and you know that this fleece is going to go to someone who wants to hand spin it into a yarn, they don't want to have to deal with all of that organic material that normally would be picked up by the sheep. So we are very careful about the way we take care of our sheep, and therefore hand spinners seek us out and are willing to wait a year, a year and a half before they get their fleece, because they're not all that available in this country at the moment, or even in England, and we keep them very, very, very clean for the hand spinner's purpose.
Wow, and this coating process, I mean, is that like walking them through like a little sheepy car wash where they're sprayed down with something, or what does that mean, coating?
No, we actually purchase or make ourselves jackets and coats. People probably might be familiar with seeing horses with coats on. In the wintertime, horses are coated. Our sheep are coated for a different reason. They don't need the warmth, but they do need the protection of keeping stuff out of their fleece. In the winter, when they have been shorn and most of their fleece is removed, I have a heavier coat that I put on them, and sometimes even line it with a fabric liner to keep them a little bit warmer until they're growing more fleece. And in the summertime, I put an extremely lightweight coat on them that I make myself, so that when they go out into the pastures, they stay clean, but they also are not overheated. So when you put these coats on them, you can't just put the coat on and leave it. You have to check the sheep. The sheep sometimes are growing and they need different sizes, or they get tangled up, or they get caught on something. So it's really not it's a very hands-on process to keep your sheep coated so that there isn't a lot of stuff that gets into that fiber, and yet keep the health of the sheep so they're not overheated or too cold.
Wow, that sounds like it would be quite a sight driving by your farm to see the sheep out on the pasture in their little coats.
Yes, it is.
So now you have mentioned that the breeds that you're working with are fairly rare. So I'm assuming, you know, you can't just kind of go down to your local, you know, live auction market and pick one up. So how does your breeding program work? Where did you get your initial genetic stock? And then how do you maintain your herd?
Well, our breeds, the Wensleydales and the Teeswaters, are British breeds. And because I think there was someone at one point in history that did bring some into this country, but they since perished. So there was some interest in these breeds maybe 10 or 15 years ago, and the government will not allow us to bring in live animals, at least sheep, no livestock, because of various health reasons and hoof and mouth and all that kind of stuff. So you cannot bring a Wensleydale into this country to start breeding. So what we do instead is we use what we call a foundation ewe, which is a ewe that is registered in a breed that's very similar to the one we're trying to recreate. And then we have someone collect semen from a purebred ram in the UK, in England, and bring the semen over, and we inseminate the ewe with the semen, the purebred semen, and then we keep track of the offspring as a percentage of how much genetic material that offspring carries. And over six generations, we hope to get up to 96%, which we're considering a purebred American Teeswater or a purebred American Wensleydale. So to answer your question, we're building genetically without having the physical animal here, which is kind of a trick, and it takes a long time and it's pretty costly, and that's how we started how shepherds started to breed these sheep. And now we're to the point where we have used quite a bit of different semen, and there are quite a few flocks within the United States, and we all have a registry where we keep track of who's related to who and that, all that kind of thing, kind of a genealogy. And we sell within our, shepherds within the association will sell animals if we have some that bring new genetics to each of our flocks.
Wow. And the process of, is there some like website I go to and I can order a vial of Wensleydale, yes, you know, sheep semen,
actually,
and it just ships it right to me?
It's fairly difficult to collect, and you have to go through an awful lot of red tape and bureaucracy to be approved to collect semen and bring it to this country. So there are very few people that do so. And there are also very few people that do the insemination. It is not an easy process with sheep. It's a laparoscopic surgery. So it's not easy for the ewe. It's not simple, and so the fellow that I use, there aren't very many people that do it in the country at all, but the people that we use, his name is Martin Daly, and he does have a website. It is www.toprams.com, and he has a list there of all the different breeds he has collected, and he also has a tutorial sort of or explanation of what the process is like to do the artificial insemination, but it is not particularly easy. It's not something that you do lightly or quickly, and the semen is pretty expensive.
Wow, that's fascinating. And we just have a few minutes left, but I want to kind of quickly, if you can take us through the life cycle of a sheep, just in kind of broad, entry-level biology class strokes, what is the gestation period, and then how long between that and your first kind of wool harvest, and then how frequently can you harvest, and what's like the retirement plan for an animal raised for fiber production?
Okay, well, first of all, let me just preface this by saying each shepherd sort of finds his own style of shepherding. I will tell you our style. It is not necessarily how other folks do it. Certainly the larger breeders who have hundreds and hundreds of sheep maintain their flocks quite differently than we do as a small farm. And again, there's quite a bit of difference between how people want to run their flock and how they handle their sheep. So what I'm going to tell you is about my style, but it is not necessarily how most people do this. The gestation of sheep is 5 months. So we normally, our breed is, the ewes go into estrus. They go into a heat cycle when the days get shorter in the fall. You can, however, force their estrus cycle by chemically inducing it so that you have total control over when they will lamb, and some people do that. So they would normally be bred probably in October. perhaps November. They're put in with a ram. The ram, the ewe, is only interested in the ram if she's in heat. She will only allow the ram to get close to her if she's actually cycling. So other than that, she wants nothing to do with him. So we only put the ram in for a short period of time. And if she allows him to get close to her, then she's ready to cycle, and they'll actually mate. The gestation is, again, about 5 months. Usually sheep have twins. It's very common. You can have, many have singles, some have triplets, some have more than triplets, but by far the vast majority, I would say, are singles, twins, and triplets. Different breeds, some breeds are known for having an easy time of lambing, and some breeds need a little bit of help. We are always there when our lambs are born because our sheep are very rare and we don't have very many of them, and we can't afford to lose any of our lambs, so we're always there at the birth to make sure that there are no issues. Sometimes we do have to go in and change the position of the lambs so that they come out correctly, or help them once they're out. But normally lambs come out and they stand up within minutes and they nurse within minutes, and it's an amazing sight. It really is. If you get a chance to go to a farm that's just had lambs, it's an amazing thing how quickly they stand and are up and nurse and actually can run within hours of being born. They're lovely. Our sheep are shorn twice a year, which again is sort of not normal. The long wool breeds grow very fast. Their fleece grows very quickly, so we shear in the spring and in the fall. Many other breeds of sheep only shear once a year. Sheep have to be shorn unless they're hair sheep. Man has removed the normal natural way that sheep would shed their fleeces, and so they have to be shorn. You can't just leave them. They will not shed.
Wow.
Because we have genetically altered sheep through domestication for so many years. You must shear them, otherwise it's not healthy. They will not shed themselves, other than a very few rare heritage breeds that are left in the world. But so we shear twice a year, and our ewes are we do not breed our lambs for the first year. When they're a year old, we don't breed them. We allow them to get to two before they have lambs themselves, because we have a very slow maturing breed. And our ewes will probably give us 6 or 7 years of lambing and then be retired or be sold as fiber animals, where they'll go to someone's farm and they won't have to carry lambs. They will instead just produce their fleece, and someone will spin it until they are too old to continue, at which point hopefully they either die peacefully on their own, or someone is looking after them that cares a great deal and makes sure that it's when they can no longer function comfortably that they're gently put out of their misery. And that would usually be, maybe 15 years or so.
Oh, wow.
Sometimes 12. And again, it depends on the animal and the breed. And again, that's not, that's the way we do it here, but there are many, many different types of management styles that don't follow that particular style.
Wow. Thank you. I know I pushed you through that quickly, and I just want to say thanks so much for hustling it out for us. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have with you today, but we'll have to bring you back on because I would love to kind of chat a little bit more. And in the meantime, if you want to see some of Virginia's work and her sheep, definitely visit www.yellowfarm.us. She also has an account through Etsy if you want to purchase some items that are finished products from her. And we are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will be on the line with Andy Rice of Hoggett Hill Farm. Thank you so much, Virginia.
Thank you.
But it's what you said, what you said. Oh, no.
If you want to be a great chef, you can't learn everything from within the walls of a classroom. That's why the French Culinary Institute has evolved into the International Culinary Center. When you come here, you don't just learn basic culinary skills. You come to understand and to feel the whole culinary world. You have to network. You have to observe the true meaning of world-class performance. You have to intern at some of the world's great restaurants. At the International Culinary Center's campuses in New York, California, and Italy, we will expose you to the whole of the culinary world, one that is evolving daily at a very high speed. The International Culinary Center offers a wide range of courses, including culinary, pastry, and bread baking, to Italian, wine, management, culinary technology, and food writing. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com.
All right, we are back, and you are tuned into the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks. You're listening to the Farm Report, and we are on the line with Andy Rice of Hoggett Hill Farm. Andy makes his living as a professional sheep shearer, and if I remember correctly, Andy, are we catching you in the middle of a shearing day?
Yep, we've done about 40-some-odd this morning, and we're going back to it as soon as we're done with this.
Wow. Well, thanks. I hope that it's a good break for you. Maybe not so restful, but thanks for taking some time out. Now, before on the first half of the show, we were talking with Virginia Sholamidi about some heritage breeds of sheep, the Wensleydale and the Tewater sheep that she raises. And I know that you do some work with the Swiss Village Foundation. And we had talked a little bit before about rare breeds and how there was a kind of this two-part need for both the semen and the eggs, which is something they do at Swiss Village. Is that right?
Right. They, if you're trying to retain some of these genetics, you need whole embryos. You can't just have the female side or the male side. So they remove all these embryos from these very rare breeds, and they freeze them in liquid nitrogen, and so they have them forever, and now and then they'll take one of the embryos and they'll drop it in a host sheep or a goat, depending on what it is, and then this is a way of checking their procedures, and all of a sudden they've got a fainting goat or a Hog Island sheep or whatever right out of the freezer, shall we say.
Wow, that's amazing. I mean, I think, you know, I'm guessing that's probably not the norm for most sheep born in the U.S. are probably coming through a more natural production.
Right, but the thing that the whole idea of preserving some of these rare breeds is, some of these breeds, for instance, like the Santa Cruz sheep that have been out on the islands in California unattended for so long, they've really developed some of their own natural parasite control. And if we can use some of these genetics in with some of our modern breeds and not have to use drugs to worm them, that we can develop natural controls, it'd be a lot better. So it's important not to lose these genetics.
Well, that is one thing we didn't get to talk into with Virginia, but I know in your role shearing that you do a lot of traveling around. You see a lot of different breeds of sheep and different farms and farm sizes. And one of the things we were curious about is kind of, What are the major health concerns for sheep, and what does that kind of management system look like, and just generally, I guess?
Well, generally, it's one of the biggest problems with sheep is parasite control, mostly internal, but some external. And so there's somewhat of a problem because some of the parasites are getting resistant to some of the drugs. So they're trying to use some of the better management techniques to control the parasites, so we don't have to use as much many pharmaceuticals, and this is some of the natural movement. But they're finding out that it really does work maintaining these different livestock.
Yeah, you just bring in a little bit of diversity. So, how you work as a professional sheep shearer? I mean, how does one get into that business?
Well, I was when I was a kid. I was the one that everybody brought, every baby bird that fell out of the nest and so on and so forth. And I worked for a zoo supplier and all kinds of stuff. And so I worked with animals all my life. And then when I came out of the service, I had a business where I did home repairs. And there was a guy who kept hiring me. And finally, because he had so many houses, and finally he hired me full time to take care of his farm and repair his equipment and so on and so forth, and he had livestock, and I started working with his livestock, and then I got livestock of my own, and somebody had to share them, so it ended up being me, and then by word of mouth, my business grew, so that's all I do full-time.
Wow, and so did you have, I mean, is there any formal certification that you're required to keep, or you just kind of self-taught and people hire you kind of based on reputation?
What happened was that some guy sheared my sheep once, and a friend of mine came over the afterwards, and he saw these sheep, they were all cut up, and he said, "You do that?" And I said, "No, I paid someone else to do it." And he said, "You should learn that yourself." So I met Bruce Clement, who was the extension agent in Cheshire County, New Hampshire at that time, and Bruce and I hit it off as friends, and Bruce taught me how to shear, and I by going farm to farm with him, and then he was also organizing some sheep shearing schools at Cornell. And so I did 8 shearing schools there with the top shearers in the world from New Zealand that would come over. And after that, it's just doing the numbers. And so you learn to go, and then people hear about you and word of mouth, and you're just traveling further and further.
Wow. So let's talk about what it looks like when you are, you know, you wake up in the morning and you're packing your car to go on a job. What type of equipment do you need? And is there like a uniform or things that you need to wear or have on your body as part of the job?
Basically, in my truck, I have some metal panels, which so I can create a pen if the person doesn't have one to hold the sheep. Then I, in terms of my equipment, it's all equipment that comes either from New Zealand, Australia, or England. Most of the stuff in this country isn't. It's just is not the quality as these countries that have, you know, a lot more sheep than we do. And but I wear jeans and for the most part in terms of clothing, but I do wear funny little wool felt shoes that are made in New Zealand or Australia, and they're shearing shoes. Sometimes I wear shearing pants that are just tighter than jeans, so there's no extra material to get in your way.
And then when you're actually at the farm, you set up, so you said you, if they don't have a, like a pen, a smaller area to contain the animal and give you space to work, you create one. And then how does the shearing process work? I mean, one animal comes in at a time, and like, I'm sure there's a special kind of hold and technique, and maybe you can just kind of paint us an audio picture of that process.
Sure. The system I use is developed in New Zealand, and they perfect it and perfect it so that the shears get more efficient. And if you've seen the movies like the Sundowners or the Thornbirds, they make a big deal about doing 200 sheep a day. Well, they've got it down now where senior open shears in New Zealand do 350 to 500 a day.
Wow.
The world's record is about 700 a day, which is, you know, 30-some-odd seconds apiece. And the system is fairly simple. The shearer grabs the sheep, sits it on its butt. Your shearing machine, if you're right-handed, is hanging on your right side. You shear the belly, and then you work your way onto the left hind leg, shearing that off. You do the neck. You lay the animal on its side. You do the left side. Then you work your way around to the other side, and it's called the whipping side, and finish up, let it go, and go grab another one. And it's just every sheep is done exactly the same. The pattern is very precise. Every stroke or blow is all a part of this pattern, and that's where it takes shears a long time to learn. In New Zealand, they say it takes 10 years or 10,000 sheep to learn how to do this.
Wow. That's like the Malcolm Gladwell magic 10,000 number. 10,000, you do anything for 10,000 hours and you're a genius at it. But I lost my train of thought. With the shearing, if people want to check it out, you can visit the Heritage Radio Network Facebook page. I did post a video of you doing it. And one of the things I thought was so amazing from the video is just how calm and relaxed the animal seemed. And I'm sure that has in large part a lot to do with your handling skills. But what are the things that farmers need to do to prepare the animals for shearing? And then does it bother them at all? I mean, do you get a sense of the process from their perspective?
Well, the whole trick is to keep the animal comfortable and relaxed. And the better a shearer gets, the more relaxed the animal is. And when people see me shear a sheep and they say, gee, that animal is really quiet and relaxed, it has really nothing to do with the sheep. It has to do with the shearer and how you control them. And whether the sheep like it or not, it's hard to say. They most probably feel very different when they losing a coat that was anyplace from 4 pounds to, you know, 20-some-odd pounds, depending on the breed and the size of the sheep. But there's some confusion within the flock because then the sheep don't recognize each other. And a lot of times the babies don't even recognize their mother. And within a few hours, they figure it all out and everything's fine.
Wow, it's interesting because I think often we think of animals as being slightly less visual in their recognition. I mean, I do anyway. So that does sound like it might be a little confusing. One of the other things I read, I was looking through the Vermont Cooperative Extension's kind of what to do before you call a sheep shearer, and they recommended withholding food and or water for a period of time before shearing. And why would you want to do that?
Well, there's a few reasons. First of all, what goes in must come out. And so you're trying to keep the board clean, you're trying to keep the fleece clean, so you don't want the animals urinating or defecating, you know, while you're shearing. But, you know, it's like, would you do an aerobics class on a full stomach? No, you'd be a lot more comfortable if your stomach was empty when you start exercising. And it's just not healthy for a sheep to have a full belly when you shear it. So that's why we suggest that they remove food and water. And, you know, 18, 24 hours is fine. And it doesn't bother the animal a bit. And they have quite a large septic tank in there. It's not empty. It's just there's less in it, so to speak. And it's better for the sheep, it's better for the shearer. But that's one of the things. There's a whole list of things that a shearer expects that the sheep are readily available. As, you know, shearers don't get paid to chase sheep. They get paid to shear sheep. So they should be right there, readily available. They should be dry. There should be adequate people to, you know, manage the fleece and keep the shearing board clean. And the better you do that, the higher quality the product is that you produce.
Yeah, that was something I noticed from the video. I mean, kind of like when I go to get my hair cut, there's usually a man or a woman running around kind of sweeping up the clipped ends, and same kind of deal for the sheep. You had a little helper there. So we learned from Virginia in the last segment that because of the domestication process of sheep over the last, you know, I'm just throwing a number out there, 100 years, that you actually have to shear most varieties of sheep because they wouldn't kind of go through a natural shedding process on their own. And I just wanted to, you know, follow up on that point and ask, you know, what's the bare minimum or the maximum that someone would be shearing a particular animal?
Well, basically, what happened was that the sheep shed normally, and as Mad bred them, it's the shed just like a dog or a cat, and as Mad bred the sheep to have more and more wool, at some point in that process, then the sheep stopped shedding, and then they had to figure out how to shear them, and a sheep today has more than 10 times the wool on it than it did as a wild animal, and there are a few breeds that still will shed partially. And then there's some hair breeds that will shed as just a, like any other mammal will shed. But and the different wool on the different sheep depends on how often they're shorn, and depending on what you're doing with the wool will make a difference. For instance, if you have a breed that grows an 8-inch fleece, then that's great for a hand spinner. They would love it 8 inches long, and so once a year you would shear it. But if you were going to use that breed to sell your wool commercially, it's too long for the machinery. So you would shear it twice a year because then you get 2 4-inch clips that the machinery could handle to spin into yarn.
Okay.
Use that breed.
That makes sense. Now, historically, it looked like from the video that you were using electric clippers, and I'm just wondering, you know, how some of that tool has evolved over the past century. I mean, was it originally, I'm assuming, a knife, and then it transitioned to an electric tool, or?
Originally, they used some very crude stone and bone knives. And then most of the Western world went to what we call a set of blades, which looks like a crude pair of scissors. And there are a lot of blade shears still today. A good blade shearer can shear 200 sheep in a day. Kevin Ford from Charlemont, Massachusetts, is a full-time professional shearer just like I am. He prefers to use blades. I use a machine which was developed during the Industrial Revolution when they were doing things in more and more mechanical ways of doing things. But it's no different than, you know, you can cut a tree down with an axe or you can cut a tree down with a chainsaw. It comes down either way. It just depends on which piece of machinery you prefer. Some people like using axes. Some people like using chainsaws. Doesn't matter. You still get firewood.
Still get firewood, and you still need skill to manage either tool, I guess. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
I had a chief in the Navy who taught me one of the greatest lessons of life. A typewriter cannot misspell. Has to do with the operator.
Very true. Very true. Well, we're just about out of time, but I wonder before we go, what do you think the future of sheep shearers is going to look like? Is this a profession that is on the decline, or is it increasing? I mean, what's demand, and what do you see in the future for sheep shearers?
Well, they've tried to come up with mechanical ways of shearing sheep. There was a machine in Australia that was a computer, laser, whatever. Took 5 minutes to get the sheep in the machine, and it only could shear 60% of the sheep. The machine cost millions and millions of dollars. Didn't work. The Chinese have been trying to come up with an injection that the wool falls out. It's basically like when somebody has chemotherapy and their hair falls out. It's just a chemical strength. But you can't do it on animals that are bred and so on and so forth. So they really haven't come up with a new system, and it's as long as they're sheep, you're going to have people who know how to shear them.
That makes sense. I think it's also kind of nice to hear. So any recommendations for someone who, after hearing this interview, will be compelled to become a sheep shearer? Where should they start?
Basically, the best way to start is most of the extension services have a local sheep shearing school in the spring. And you learn how to turn the machine on and off and how the combs and cutters work and how to handle a sheep a little. And then from there, you just need lots of practice. And if you can get teamed up with someone like myself who will teach you most of the skills and give you the opportunity. And the problem is you have to find people who are willing to let you learn. You know, the sheep can get nicked or cut, and they heal up just fine. It's not a big deal. But the only way to learn is by shearing sheep. And so it's important that people let a youngster or somebody new learn on their sheep. You got to start somewhere.
Yeah, I definitely used to, when I was a poor college student, get my hair cut at the local, hair cutting school, which had mixed results, but was kind of good for me at the time. Andy, thank you so much for taking some time out of what I understand is a pretty busy day to share some info with us. If people want to get in touch with you or follow up, what's the best way to reach you?
The best way is to reach me through email. And my email address is shearwool, SHEARWOOL, at hotmail.com.
Awesome. Well, thanks to Andy and thanks to Virginia for being guests on the show today. Also want to send a special thanks to my producer, Mary Jean Packer, and my engineers today, Joe and Jack, double teaming it in the Heritage Radio Network studio. You can always find archived episodes of the Farm Report on the heritageradionetwork.org and on iTunes as a podcast. Remember, we're live every Thursday at 1 p.m. And if you have any questions for the show, you can email us at info@heritageradionetwork.org. See you next week, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.